The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Thursday, January the 28th, 2021. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Well, welcome to a midweek or late week edition of the show. A lot of news coming out yesterday. Wanted to come to you before Sunday because I really think a lot of stuff is going to go stale quick, and I think there's big news coming down. I don't have any information on that, but I think big news is coming down, and I think that what happened last night late with the trade of Steven Matz to the Blue Jays for three prospects is a sign of things to come. So I figured let's jump in and get right at it. I do have a guest that I had a chance to catch up with, as the plan was really to take a lighter show as we wait out the back half here of the hot stove and potentially things heating up, and whether or not things really heat up before the Super Bowl. Who the hell knows? It's such a slow-moving hot stove. But Lou Schiff, Baseball and Law, on Twitter, and I talk about the news of the DH not being, as of now, part of the National League. We talk about the benefits of the DH, our thoughts on the DH, and we also briefly get into the news about Curt Schilling, his letter to the BBWAA, the Hall of Fame. I know we talked about that at length on Sunday with Kevin Kernan, but I want to get into that briefly, just to put a little bow on it. But what you really want to hear about is the Mets. So first, quick, we'll go real quick here because, you know, we're not going to belabor those points. Aaron Loop, lefty reliever, once they lost out on Brad Hand. And it's really interesting when you look at the Brad Hand contract with the Nationals, all the deferred money on a one-year deal. Nationals, Mets got criticized under Wilpon ownership for deferrals and Bobby Bonilla and all the things. But the Nationals do a ton of deferring of money, a ton. They've been doing that for years. And I'm sure there's a very good financial reason. It's nothing to be made fun of. But from a player standpoint, the benefit, I guess there's interest. But I would think the Mets could have, even on a one-year deal with the same money, could have matched that. So clearly it was about closing. And I think the last time we came to you, I think Hand had already not had signed yet with Washington. So that came down late on Sunday. But not crying over that. It would have been nice to have Brad Hand. He wanted to close. He wanted to be closer to his home in spring training. There are things outside of money, unless you really blow somebody away, which the Mets were not going to, nor should they have done that just to have somebody. That would have been, let me have somebody because I want them type of move. Once that happened, then I was like, all right, Justin Wilson, you know him. Jake McGee's out there, although I've had some people tell me that he's a one-pitch pitcher. Dodgers have done a good job of trying to work on him with his location. And I never really thought of Aaron Loop. So Aaron Loop is, what's interesting about him is he's lefty, of course, but he's a sidewinder. The Rays know how to find these guys, and he was successful even before Tampa when he was in Toronto. He was a solid reliever. But the Rays always seem to find the right guys, whether it be through their system or free agency. The most important thing, and I'll get deeper, I keep saying it, and I will, because we're going to go through the Mets bullpen before spring training. The thing I like about him is his walks are very low. They're below 2 per 9. They're going to be below 3 per 9. So you get a couple of really nice things there. One, you get a guy who's lefty, who gets lefties out at a high rate, and can get righties out. Very important in the three-batter world that we live in. Two, he's got a different look. He gives you a different look with the sidewinder than a Castro or a Betances type of situation. And he keeps the ball in the ballpark, and he doesn't put runners on base via the walk. And that's been the Mets' biggest problem in the bullpen. And that's where they could improve the most. And Familia and Betances are the biggest culprits. Although there are rumors, so now, you know, Matt's, his money's out, that Familia may be on the way too. Nothing credible, but I saw some rumblings out there. So there's that. Then Mets announced the second big hit as we went through the news yesterday. Mets announced that Zach Scott will be the acting GM. I'm not surprised there. Mets may bring in a veteran GM like Billy Epler to mentor Scott. We talked about that on the last podcast. Sometimes be a big boy, grow up, go do the job. You know, you could have people to help you and give you advice, but, you know, to coddle people through this job, I don't agree with. But any kind of and Billy Epler's well-respected. If you could bring somebody into the front office that could add context and perspective and have relationships throughout baseball, who's been doing it a long time, whether you like the Yankees or not, they still run a really good organization for many, many years. Bring that guy in. And Billy Epler, who was fired as the Angels GM, very well may be joining the Mets. But Zach Scott, and I said, I thought I was very impressed with him on the Feinsohn podcast. Very analytically driven, perfect guy to head up. And they've already brought over some big names. Looks like Ben Zahmer, I think his name is, from the Dodgers as a big win for the analytics department. Mets are going to fix that part of their operation. They're going to spend money there. You don't have an owner that comes from Wall Street in the hedge fund world where quants and analytics and data is their game and not improve on that. That's going to happen. And the Mets are going to make it happen. And they have a guy in Zach Scott that comes from a fantasy baseball background all those years ago, just like Jared Porter, grew up in the Red Sox organization, hopefully has the people skills to and relationships to master that part of the job. You know what? The media and all that stuff, he'll work it on that. You know, maybe he won't be a great quote. Maybe he'll be boring. Maybe they won't look forward to seeing him on Zoom. But that's not necessarily the most important part of the job. It is a piece of the job. Hopefully he can have the people around him from a scouting point of view to incorporate that very important part of the equation. That's why I liked Porter, and I thought he and Porter were a great mix. And I saw Zach Scott as part of the cabinet. But look, this is what you have now. Porter's gone. To go through an exhaustive GM search, not necessarily the right thing to do. Alderson cannot do everything. You could certainly plug it with Alderson in the short term, but you need someone who's a little bit more progressive, has worked in the game recently, has more recent ideas. That's not Alderson. I'm sorry, that's not Alderson. So I'm fine with it. We'll see where it goes. Does Zach Scott turn out to be miscast where he's a cabinet member in the big seat? We'll see. He may not get the job full time, but I think the reports were they were very impressed with him, and they're going to give him every opportunity to get this job. And we wish him well. He seemed like a nice guy talking, on that podcast. And I recommend, if you haven't listened to it, go to the Feinsohn podcast. Mark Feinsohn, who has executive access, listen to Zach Scott. You'll hear about his background, his history, and some of the things that got him to where he is today. Okay, then there was the big move, and obviously it was a good move from a baseball standpoint, but it did come with some, I think, sadness, because you traded a local kid and a guy who's been with the Mets organization a long time. I mean, we were talking, at least me and the cohorts, you know, good buddy Joe DiMeo over at the That's So Mets podcast, SNY. We were talking about Steven Matz back at the old NYBD site back in 2009. I remember how he was struggled so much with the injuries, Tommy John, took him 6 years to make the big leagues, had that great debut. Who didn't like that Sunday doubleheader debut when Steven Matz made his the start at Shea Stadium, got a couple of hits. You know, his grandfather was up there in the press box or the luxury box, or the family box, can't remember what it was. And he was going crazy. Long Island kid. And I remember what was cool is that they were so young, the Mets, at that time, all these young pitchers, that he and DeGrom, I believe, were hanging out. And I think Mats took him home with him to either his parents' house or where he grew up on Long Island, which is right near where I am. And he was over there getting a sandwich over at the Seaport Deli over there up in the Stony Brook area. And it's like, you know, what Kevin Kernan said on Sunday, the players live in the neighborhood, they play the game, and there's that connection. Now, you're not going to get that forever because those were very young pitchers, you know, making league minimum and just starting out and basically half a minor leaguer when you think about it, in the mindset anyway. So that's a long time ago. You know, Mats doesn't even live on Long Island anymore. But it was cool to have somebody that grew up from the area, went to school in the area, had that connection. And I could tell you, I have a friend in minor league baseball. And when he was called up, I had called him and said, you know, I know he's in the Pacific Coast League, Mats, but what do you think? He said, Mike, you know, I got a scout friend that said, best pitcher he's seen in the Pacific Coast League maybe in over 10 years. And a lot of people that this particular guy had spoken to thought he would be better than Noah Syndergaard. And these were people that were in the Mets organization or people that were connected to the Mets. And that didn't happen. Now, Mats, remember something. Before you call his career failure, he went through his injuries with the big league club. He's been a below league average five-starter type for a couple of years now, very frustrating at times. He would have great outings, and he was awful last year, with the exception of maybe one or two starts. But he came up in 2015, helped that team who was struggling with some of their back end of the rotation. He and Syndergaard were a big upgrade over Nice and Dylan G. And he started a game against Kershaw in the postseason in the NLDS, and he lost that game, but he kept the Mets in the ballgame. You weren't going to beat Kershaw that night. That was the night they were going to try to clinch it at Citi Field, and then they had to go to L.A. to win it. Pitched in the World Series, very good Game 5. Mets lost that game in extra innings, not because of Mats. Not easy to do that. Young pitcher, first time up pitching in the World Series. Was shaky against the Cubs in the NLCS in the clinching game. Got bailed out by David Wright, a big play there. But, you know, look, he was there, and he kept them just enough in the game to get them to where they need to be. Everyone talks about Bartolo Colon. Bartolo Colon didn't start in the postseason. He was coming out of the bullpen. It was Steven Matz. So Steven Matz has some, albeit a disappointing Mets career, but has some nice moments. And I personally think he's a great guy. Does a lot for charity. These are good guys. But it's a baseball. Baseball's a business, and the train keeps moving. So the train moves, and the Mets get basically three minor leaguers. How useful they will be, who knows. None of the deals, and I won't, because I'm sure Zach Scott was involved in this, and maybe because who knows how long it was been in the play, maybe Jared Porter as well was working on that. Hopefully, because this was one of the things that Porter, while you brought him on, he kind of saw some of this undervalued assets that potentially were in those deals. The story, I think it was Peter Gammons or Bill James said about how when they made that deal with Andrew Miller, how they were able to go out there and find the best prospect, maybe not the one that everyone was talking about, but find the prospects that made sense. Maybe that falls into this. Look, Sean Reed Foley, Yency Diaz, Josh Winkowski. I'm sure somebody will email me saying I botched that, but Sean Reed Foley, Yency Diaz, Josh Winkowski. Reed Foley and Diaz are pitchers that could potentially pitch a second game with a doubleheader, provide you depth 7-8, 7-8, 9-10. The Mets needed that. They have options, so you don't have to worry about passing them through waivers. Winkowski, younger, A-ball, some good numbers. The only thing I was able to get feedback on was Diaz. Clean delivery, nice changeup, throws hard, about 96 miles an hour. That's from a scout I know. So I don't think any of these guys are going to go out there and make you forget Steven Matz and what he did in 2015 or 2016. Who knows? But they're going to be useful pieces on the roster, and it's the depth. It's the little things that help you win a championship. And the Mets don't have enough pitching depth. And that's really where I go, where this move has to be a precursor, in my opinion, to something much bigger. Because The Mets needed Steven Matz at the back end of the rotation because now you have, let's assume no other move. You have DeGrom, you have Carrasco. I'm drawing a blank. Could you believe it? DeGrom, Carrasco, Stroman, Lucchesi. Jeez, I'm drawing a blank. Could you believe it? And Peterson. Right, Peterson. And then Syndergaard coming back in some point in time in the first half, you think. I'm a little shaky with Peterson and Lucchesi as those four and five. I mean, Lucchesi's a nice, I mean, he's probably going to be able to give you exactly what Steven Matz gave you in 2018 and 2019 as a starter. I mean, he could give you that. Now, his Petco Park numbers were a lot better than on the road, and that's a pitcher's ballpark, but forget about it. I'm not going to get crazy. Who knows? They did their due diligence on him. I have to think another pitching move is on the way. And if they trade Familia, I think that's an even bigger sense about that. And yeah, maybe this is to make room for Jackie Bradley Jr. so you shore up the defense. Or who knows what they're going to do with another value-driven arm. I mean, Corey Kluber, guys like that, Garrett Richards getting $10, $11 million a year. Steven Matz at $5 million is a bargain. Because I got to tell you, you're going to tell me Steven Matz is any worse than Garrett Richards? I don't know if Steven Matz is worse than Corey Kluber at this point. Yes, he needed to change his scenery. No doubt. For him, this is great. But for the Mets, $5 million, Steven Matz, that's a deal you'd be looking for on the open market. So there's got to be something big coming. And I really think now you heard the Angels are out, and it was underreported, but if you read MVP Machine, and I think I've mentioned this before on the show, the book, great book, which Bauer is featured in there because of the methods that he himself went out to seek and employ from technology to improve his game. He and Mickey Callaway didn't get along, and the reason was Mickey Callaway was a much more traditional pitching coach than, I guess, he positioned himself, because he was positioning himself coming to Mets as a great, innovative, forward-thinking guy. A team that was stuck with guys like Worth and Collins that were not anything close to innovative. So it was interesting, and I never thought of that, because I brought it up, and it should have been the first thing where I'm saying, if you listen to Bauer's video, he wants to be able to employ his methods and be able to take ownership in his development. That didn't happen with Callaway, and I'm not sure he's going to go back for round two with Callaway on that. So it makes sense that now you have the Mets, the Dodgers are out there. Certainly he's from California. He said location's not going to matter. He wants to be able to win. Mets can win. He wants to be able to go out there and employ his methods and embrace with the organization, and hopefully they offer him progressive, analytically driven ideas of how he can improve his performance. And the Dodgers certainly fit all of those, so that's a threat. But the Mets can offer those too, albeit they don't have the same track record. So the chances are that this market is really coming to the Mets. It's probably going to be a shorter-term deal of 4 years. There's going to be an opt-out in there. There's certainly going to be risk with that, but I think it's going to be far less risky than going out there and signing a pitcher like the Yankees did with Gerrit Cole for long-term for that kind of huge total sum of money. So I think something big's coming. Maybe by the time this goes up this morning, something big will happen. This will go stale. But there is other things we could talk about which make this worthwhile. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, Curt Schilling told the Hall of Fame, specifically the Baseball Writers Association of America, "I don't need you. They can't handle it." What's next? My reaction on the vote right after this. The Talking Mets podcast is available on many outlets, but the most popular is Apple Podcast. Hi, I'm Mike Silva, the host of the Talking Mets podcast, and I encourage you to leave a review about the program on Apple. Just rate it 1 to 5 stars, hopefully a 5, because why wouldn't you? And then if you have time, leave a review. It helps the podcast continue to grow and encourages others to take a listen. You can also email me at MikeSilva@TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Hope to hear from you soon. And enjoy the rest of the show. All right, we're back. I'm not going to go too deep into the Hall of Fame. You guys heard my vote on Sunday with Kevin Kernan. You could go back and listen to that. You heard Kevin Kernan's vote. If you don't want to go back, or you really want to know real quick, what I would have liked to have seen is, I'm a Bonds and Clemens guy. They were Hall of Famers before the steroids. Bonds, if you want to go up to 1998, and there's a guy that was a Gold Glove outfielder, 30 stolen bases at times, 30 home runs, led off at one point. By the end of that run, was a middle of the order, not too far off from the Bonds that people was the cartoon Bonds. He was still probably top three, four, five hitters all time, and maybe was a all around better player before the steroids. He was much more offensive minded after the steroids. So I think the Bonds up to 98 was a Hall of Famer if you use that as a demarcation line. Same thing with Clemens before his Blue Jays renaissance, 192 wins, far better than the next two pitchers, Maddox and Doc, during that era. I talked about Scott Rolen and how Scott Rolen compares very well with overall statistics to guys like Ron Santo. And to me, there's enough similarities between other Hall of Fame third basemen. He's 11th all time when you look at wins above replacement. And then from an offensive standpoint, the era, you know, Manny Ramirez, Gary Sheffield, right-handed bats. Manny might be the best overall right-handed hitter of that era, one of the best all time. You know, the late Hank Aaron, no disrespect, but Manny Ramirez from a run creation was every bit that hitter. Sheffield was right there with greats of the 90s in terms of offense with, you know, the Ken Griffey Jr.'s and Mike Piazza's and things like that. And then, you know, Jeff Kent, who I've been on the fence, and I know Mets fans probably don't like hearing it, you know, best second baseman during a 10-year period, better than Robbie Alomar, better than Craig Biggio from statistics, and those guys are in the Hall of Fame. So you could go back and listen to Sunday's show if you want to get more in-depth. Now, the guy that I was always on the fence, and it was Curt Schilling, but when I started to look, and a great analogy or great comparison that Kevin Kernan gave on Sunday was, you know, Curt Schilling's Jack Morris. Maybe he wasn't always the best pitcher every year in terms of statistics, but he had that big postseason moment, and Schilling had a couple. I mean, when Arizona and Boston, and in a way, even though Minnesota had that great win and that historic performance that Morris did in Game 7 in 1991, Schilling with the bloody sock game, what the Red Sox did in 2004, to me, that's one of the best baseball moments all time. I mean, that was, you know, you have to be there. I was there watching those games, how historic it was and how big it was to beat the Yankees and come back and do what they did. So I thought Schilling should be in. Now, I didn't think he would get in because it was close with the Ryan Thibodeau. You know, he collects the ballots at about 40%, and the other 50 or 60% that were left, your numbers always go down. So you got to be above 75, in a lot of ways significantly above when Thibodeau puts that stuff out before the vote to get in. And Clemens and Bonds were at 70, 71. Schilling only dropped a few points, and he missed it by 16 votes. Bonds and Clemens are kind of stuck in this 61, 62. So I'm with Kevin Kernan. He gave, you know, perfect way he put it. At some point, and it really leads into the real controversy with Schilling, put it in the hands of the committee at the Hall of Fame. Let the peers figure out these steroids guys. You got Manny Ramirez, definitely Hall of Famer, nowhere close to getting in. Same with Sheffield. I don't know if you want to say Sheffield's definitely, but great case. Bonds and Clemens, there's no doubt. Put Bonds and Clemens in the committee. Let them figure this thing out, because clearly it's too toxic for the Baseball Writers Association of America to figure these guys out and look at it the way I looked at it, which I believe is very fair and common sense. Now, the thing with Schilling is you can, if you want to use advanced metrics like WAR, which I know there's probably still a good percentage of the committee, the BBWAA, that's not going to do that. He's a Hall of Famer. He's 20th all time. And you talk about Jack Morris, and I'll say this about Kernan's analogy, very much a good analogy. And Morris pitched longer into games and had more wins. But when you look at overall numbers, Jack Morris did flush out very league average statistically. And Schilling's not that. I mean, Schilling's like John Smoltz. Schilling's like Tom Glavine. Schilling's like Fergie Jenkins. Look at the numbers. It's not me making it up. And you could go to Baseball Reference if you want, and maybe it's a little bit different. But it's all in the same, you know, the same measurements, and the same players will show up in those little clusters. Trust me. I used a little bit more Fangraphs this year. I'm liking Fangraphs a little bit more than Baseball Reference. No knock on either one. Both are great sites. Now, Schilling is upset by the way he's being portrayed in the media. So he sends, and this is where it's great. Basically, You know, remember when A-Rod said the truth shall set you free? Remember that when he was having all those issues with the media, putting a ton of pressure on himself, and he finally said, screw it. And he became clownish at the times toward the end of his career, and maybe he took that to an extreme, but he was kind of like the old person that lets it go and finally takes all this weight that they hold. Because what a lot of times what happens with people is they spend their careers trying to be what everyone else wants them to be and what the, you know, expectations need to be instead of just being who they are. And I always say the biggest issue with the media and the fans here in this town is they don't manage expectations. Sometimes they create these ideas of what things should be. So if you don't perfectly meet those expectations, you fail. One of the things I think we have to stop doing is putting this idea of who these people are as people. Because forget politics. Everybody's got their issues, and everyone's going to rub people the wrong way. If you put all baseball players that are on your 40-man roster and worked in an office environment with them, just like your office or your place of work, whatever you do, there's going to be people that do a really good job on a field that you're going to start to say, that guy really annoys me. I don't like him. Now, does that mean he's not a good pitcher? Is that a good hitter? Is that a good manager? No. But that's not why you watch the game. You're watching them for three and a half hours a night for their performance, for what they can do on the field, not for who they date, not for how they think about the voting process of the president of the United States, not for their belief systems on all these other things. Now, there is clear good and bad in people. And I've seen some of the things that Schilling has put out there. I wouldn't put that out there on social media. Hanging journalists, not something I'd do on social media. He definitely has issues with the media throughout his career. And I saw the quote, and Kevin gave it on the Sunday show. He was a horse on the day he pitched, and a horse is you-know-what the other 4 days. Clearly, people around him said that. I think it was Ed Wade, the former GM of the Phillies, that came up with that. So there's validity to that. Now, what really made – there was two things that drove me crazy yesterday when the vote came out. Nobody made it. So here's the BBWAA in a time where they could be marketing their product, the product they cover. I don't think they care about that. All these great players from a decade, none of them are going to be at the Hall of Fame, which potentially could be this summer with the way things are opening up around the country. I still have my doubts, but we'll see a Hall of Fame ceremony next summer for sure. And you can have all these players from a generation of younger fans, you know, maybe not all my age in the 40s, but even younger that watch them really get engaged and enjoy baseball. But no, they're not going to have that. Now, maybe part of that is they want Derek Jeter to have center stage, because I think that's something that in their weird fantasy world that they value. But Buster only writes on Twitter, and Buster drives me crazy sometimes because he's another problem child when it comes to thought process. Moving forward, the baseball writers would be best served by insisting the Hall of Fame apply the character clause itself. Let the Hall of Fame declare which players have passed its character test before forwarding the ballot of eligible players to writers. How about we just stop looking at character? How about that? Because now that's going to open up a whole Pandora's box, and you wonder, you know, well, what is, you know, you're going to go back and you're going to have to start kicking people out of the Hall of Fame. And who at the Hall of Fame is going to do that character test? Is it just going to be the committee, the Veterans Committee? Because I got to tell you, I'd love to start looking at some of the Veterans Committee and their backgrounds and look under the hood. The writers are basically saying, I can't handle this. So guess what, guys? Let's take it one step further. We'll just have the committee do, just like the other sports, do the vote. Maybe we'll get you get different players from different eras, and you put together a committee and let them vote. And you know what? I bet you it'll be a better vote. It'll take away some of the fun of Thibodeau and his ballot counting. We could still have the same debate, and they don't have to listen to the sanctimony. And a friend of mine on Facebook, you guys know him, he's been on the show, Joe Cassell, former sports agent, still involved in the business. He said the real problem is that the writers have turned this into a me. Look at me. Look at my video about my ballot. Look at how pious I am. Look at my morals. I'm going to be better than everybody else. It's like when members of the media have to put pictures of themselves wearing a mask on their profile. That's for them to say, look, I do the right thing. You should. People aren't going to do something because you do it. I don't need you to do it. I'm not a child. I could figure out things for my own way. I could figure out morality on my own way. I don't need you in a profile picture in Twitter or video about the Hall of Fame to do that. That drives me crazy. So Schilling then says, you know what? Take me off. I'll let the Veterans Committee decide my fate. And I didn't read the manifesto, and I don't care. I don't need to read it. That's the point. And he's got a wife going through health issues. Feel bad for the guy in that sense. Nobody should have to go through that. Forget about their political beliefs. And the writers get well, you can't do that. You can't do that. It's like, well, he's saying, I don't need your validation. And they can't handle it. They're throwing a tantrum. It was a beautiful thing. And I said, God bless Curt Schilling. Finally, truth shall set me free. I don't need you. I don't need you to validate me. And if the Veterans Committee decides I'm not worthy, oh, fine. And he kind of bounced in there. Maybe he even knows. Look, he's a smart guy. He knows that he's a borderline candidate. He's got a very good case, better case. But when you say Curt Schilling's name, I didn't think Hall of Famer right away. When you say Bonds and Clemens, I broke down those numbers. I didn't need to break down those numbers. I saw them play earlier in their career. I saw them play late in their career. I knew both versions were Hall of Famers. Roland, Sheffield, Schilling, Kent, you had to dive into it. And maybe that's part of the problem, maybe, but that's a small hall mindset too. So Schilling says, I don't need you. And guess what? All of us could learn from that. Because if you spend the better part of your career or your life looking for other people to give you the validation that you just should give yourself, you know, you're going to have a very miserable existence. And I think that's the problem. Everybody's trying to outdo everybody with the look at me. You know, I think Joe Consal said it best. Look at me. Look at my vote. Look how pious I am. Look how my morals are better. I have the right attitude. I'm part of the club. Just talk baseball. I don't need to see you with a picture of a mask. I don't need to hear about your morals. I don't need you to out-moral the next guy. Believe me, there's no life lesson that I'm going to learn from a baseball writer or from a sideline reporter or from a politician. I'll do those on my own. You'll do those on your own. Let's just talk baseball. Now, real quick, Sean, and this was a good column, Sean McAdam over at the Boston Sports Journal wrote a piece about he was disappointed in seeing who Schilling has become. He knew Schilling. Sean wrote for the Providence Journal, guy who grew up in Massachusetts and, obviously bleeds Boston sports. Perfect guy to report on the teams there. You know, they have those blinders as Bostonites, but it that connection with the fans, you grow up. It's like me, what I do here. I grew up a Mets fan. Now I'm trying to report. You know, you leave your fandom behind, but because of your background, it makes you better at what you do. He wrote a very good piece, Sean McAdam, the Boston Sports Journal, saying he's disappointed about who Curt Schilling has become, not sure he'd want to interact and talk with him, but he enjoyed covering him. And here's where you have to be careful about the morals police. Who you think Curt Schilling is, when you read the article by Sean McAdam, he talks about during the World Series win in 2004, playoff shares are divvied up, and clubhouse people and all other types of workers around the organization are eligible. And I've talked to players who have done this. Not an easy thing, because as you give out more shares to more people and full shares, you take money out of other people's pocket that potentially were playing the whole season. Someone's going to lose. The players will lose. And you can say, oh, you know, some players are, you know, 1 year in the major leagues making $500,000, or what at that time the minimum was less. You're not rich for life. You need the money. But what Schilling, who was a big driver behind this with that Red Sox team, insisted that a lot of regular workers get full shares. I mean, guys getting $300,000, $250,000, $200,000, clubhouse people, back end people. Not talking about backup catchers here. Life changing money. Think about if someone at your job gave you a $300,000 check tomorrow, what that would mean for you and what you can do. And Curt Schilling had something to do with it. Now, he doesn't talk about that. Sean McAdam is talking about that. I don't think Schilling publicized that because this is the first time hearing about it. Maybe I'm wrong. But sometimes when somebody tweets something about their political views or when somebody talks sports and has a different opinion and you think, oh, you're an awful person, you don't know that person. And Sean McAdam gave you at least an inkling of an idea that, you know, Curt Schilling may have complicated thoughts about the world and maybe he's used social media poorly and maybe he's communicated his positions poorly and he may be in a bad place now because of some life situations. But that doesn't mean that you know him, and that doesn't mean everything about him is bad. And guess what? Give me a guy that helps out the people that, the small people around him, that changed it, you know, got his uniform clean, booked travel, made his life easier in a very wealthy world where maybe you could argue they should do more for themselves over the writer who wears a mask on their profile. Trust me, because that guy who wears the mask and lets you know he wears the mask or has the blue check mark or tells you how pious they are or how moral they are probably wouldn't give the $300,000 to the clubhouse person. They take it for themselves. And I'll leave you with that. God bless Curt Schilling telling the BBWA to go, you know, put it where the sun don't shine. Because guess what? A lot more people should do that. Give it. Kevin Kernan said it best. Give the vote to the hall. Let them figure it out. The Veterans Committee. All right. Lou Schiff, baseball and law. Let's debate the DH. Let's hear his thoughts. We'll be back with that and more right after this. We like to use all the advanced tools available when debating the Hall of Fame inductions at the Talkin' Mets podcast. That's why Jay Jaffe, author of the book Cooperstown Casebook, joined us to talk about his JAWS rating system.
Yeah, you know, my system, JAWS, the Jaffe Wins Above Replacement system, is based on, you know, advanced statistics, specifically Wins Above Replacement, the baseball reference formulation. You know, it's a total estimate of a player's offensive and defensive value or pitching value, and you know, the benefit of using something like that is that we do try to capture, you know, all the facets of the game, not just about the hitting milestones. It's about a player's base running. So a guy like Larry Walker, who was a tremendous runner, you know, in addition to being a great hitter, is helped. It's about defense as well. So Walker and Rowland and several other guys on the ballot are helped. You know, for so long, those categories were kind of paid lip service to, but not really thought about too hard in the context of Hall voting, and I think what we've, you know, what I've been able to bring to this and encourage others to bring to it is that total aspect, you know, because baseball history, I mean, it's a mess. It's very hard, I think, without advanced statistics to judge, you know, the relative worth of a player who's, you know, who's putting up big numbers in the 1920s and 30s or the steroid era versus the ones who are playing in, you know, say the dead ball era or, you know, the mid-60s. You know, fortunately, I think people have caught on that this is a good way of looking at it.
Listen to this and more at www.talkinmetspodcast.com. We're back, and I always like trying to bring on new guests. And joining me, you guys might be following on Twitter, and if you're not, you should, at Baseball and Law. Lou Schiff, he's a, you know, Sabre Research Award recipient, has a ton of interesting nuggets. And before you roll your eyes, say, oh, you're bringing a lawyer on, Mike. No, he's a baseball guy. He's an author. And Lou, welcome to the program. And what perfect timing. Hall of Fame controversy, CBA, DH. As we record this, who knows what's going to go on with the hot stove. But welcome to the program. How you doing?
It's great to be here, Mike. It's wonderful. I'm doing fine. I'm staying socially isolated the best that I can. And, you know, just waiting and hoping that we're going to one day be together and be able to do stuff again.
Absolutely. And, you know, it looks like the baseball season will start on time. But the rules of engagement, and I was talking about this, are still up in the air. We don't know what the expanded playoffs look like. Right now, there's no DH, which I think is patently absurd. And look, I'm a longtime National League fan. I've always been a proponent of the DH. Now, if you guys go to Baseball and Law, what really got me to bringing Lou on about the DH, and we could have went so many different directions, was back in December, he tweeted out a very interesting story, I guess I'll call it. And I didn't know this, that back in the 20s, 1928, the National League actually proposed the original DH. It was a 10-man rule, bat and run for the pitcher, which obviously was supposed to liven the game up. You know, you've heard that before, right? And helping less pitching changes. That's 1928. Not exactly modern-day baseball. Pre-integration, no you know, shifts and all that. So it's interesting. Here we are, all these almost 100 years later, we're still talking about the same thing.
So to go back, I think it was like 1929, but 1929, 1928, yeah. It seems like yesterday for most people.
Sure.
John Heidler, who was the National League president, he's the one that proposed it. And they wanted to call it the 10th man rule, which is the designated hitter. And it's everything that we know it to be today with the same things. Pitchers would be able to pitch more innings, which is kind of hard to believe because pitchers then were always pitching complete games.
Sure.
15 runs and you pitch a complete game. But it was voted down by, of all things, the American League. And wow. And so the idea sat on the shelf for years and years and years. And because everybody thinks, well, you know, Blumberg with the Yankees, he's the first designated here in 1973. It's a brand new idea, but it really wasn't a brand new idea. What was old became new. It just took time for people to say, okay, let's do it.
Now you're, listen, old transparency. We're both Brooklyn guys. You're from the Avenue U. I'm from 18th Avenue. So it's you got, regardless of how long you live there, you got that connection. There's always that connection.
And I have that accent still, no matter, I've been living.
I try to lose it.
You can't.
I try to lose it. You can't. And I listen back to replays of the show and I'm like, oh, please, Mike, stop. So
when I come up to New York to visit my cousins on the island, it's like, it's instant. It's like,
well, I got a double whammy. I've got the Brooklyn accent for 26 years, and now I've been on Long Island for 15 or 16. So I've morphed into something far more insidious for the public to listen to. So you have that. But National League, look, Brooklyn, not that I was a Dodgers fan, but I probably would have been if they had stuck around. I think that's just in the DNA of how I grew up as a sports fan. National League background, but I've always been a DH fan, more so now than ever. I think it's important. Look, you know, it with the age of pitchers now, I think pitching changes and openers and the constant parade of bad pitchers, most teams can't have 13 good quality pitchers, is bad for the game. The DH, which increases the offense, it used to be, Lou, half a run. I don't know what it is now, but in that ballpark, let's say. And I think it's necessary. I think it's necessary for the entertainment value. I think it's necessary to make pitching better. I know you'll lose out on the Jacob deGrom or the Bartolo Colon or things like that. But outside of the politics of the CBA, I don't see why that both sides wouldn't want this. I think it'll happen. I think it would be egregious if it didn't happen for 2021 and then after. But what are your thoughts as a guy growing up in Brooklyn, probably a National League guy? Are you in agreement?
So born in Brooklyn, moved to Long Island, moved to North Belmore when I was about 6 years old, stayed in North mm-hmm. Belmore till my senior year in high school, and then we moved to Florida in 1972, graduated North Miami Beach High, went to University of Florida, got a degree in journalism, went to law school in Minnesota at Hamline University. It's the only law school that accepted me, so true. I went there.
There you go.
Hey, look, you know, you go.
And you made, and you probably made the right choice, a little bit more job security being in law than in journalism, unfortunately.
And, you know, and things turned out okay. Took the bar exam right. twice. The Florida bar wrote me a letter after my first exam, told me they liked me so much they wanted me to sit for the exam a second time. So I obliged them, and I did it one more time.
There you go.
Growing up, I was a Met fan, and Jerry Kuzman comes to mind as like the world's worst hitter when it comes to a pitcher. All right. Was there anybody worse than Jerry Kuzman as a hitter?
I'd have to look at the numbers. That's an interesting take. And I'll have to look at that up after
right.
our segment.
And I might be wrong, but I do remember Jerry Kuzman like being the world's worst hitter. And, you know, he'd come up in a situation where they purposely load the bases or put somebody on. And it was all over because Kuzman stood for K and it was a strikeout. And that was the end of the inning. But as a National League fan, I really like the designated hitter because I really think it involves a different kind of strategy. But I've rethought it after last season. Hmm. And I rethought it because I'm a Marlins fan and I've been a season ticket holder since the beginning in 93 when they came down here. But as a Marlins fan, I liked what happened last year because it gave the team opportunities that we never had before.
Right.
And you see that there. Yeah, you talk about pitchers. I was at the game when Jose Fernandez hit a home run against the Braves and he did the casual bat flip and the crowd went crazy, but there was almost a fight at home plate. but that only happens once a season maybe.
Right.
And so the designated hitter, I think, would be a great thing to stay in baseball, but you've got to get the collective bargain agreement doesn't expire till the end of this season. Mm-hmm. And unless there's something in it for the players and meaning money for the players, they may not have an interest. I teach a law course at Mitchell Hamlin, which is the law school up in Minnesota in St. Paul, called Law and the Business of Baseball. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I emphasize to my students, is that the baseball is a game that's played by kids in high school, played growing up in the sandlots, but baseball played by Major League Baseball is a business.
Right.
And so it's all about the Benjamins when it comes to baseball. And so it changes a little bit. They want to put fans in the stands, like you said, and you want to see hitting. I think people really want to see hitting because we don't have. I mean, look at all the great pitchers we've lost in the last year. You know, Bob Gibson, Tom Seaver. We've lost a ton of people. Whitey Ford. There's just a ton of people have passed away. Sutton. I mean, all these great pitchers, but we don't have those kind of pitchers anymore. So the game has changed.
What's interesting is, so as you're talking, I'm like, let me go to Baseball Reference Stathead, and I'm doing some quick queries.
Uh-huh.
Now, you're right and wrong on Jerry Kuzman here, and this goes, and it's interesting about it. Jerry Kuzman career, 121 batting average. That's pretty bad. But all time, he is behind only Dwight Gooden and Tom Seaver in terms of hits. Now, that could also be longevity and things like that. Now, I also did one time I took, and I'm trying to piece this back together because it's been a few, I think it was last year. I looked at the total amount of at-bats that a pitcher had pitchers mm-hmm. for a team over the course of a season. And it was the equivalent of a homestand of a 10-game. So think about if you had a homestand, one homestand of 10 games or so, 2 weeks, let's say, mm-hmm. and you just saw pitchers play. Right. Pitchers just got up to hit. Mm-hmm. I think the quality of play, I think there'd be a lot of televisions turning off. Now, we don't look at it that way because it's only 3-4 at-bats a game, but I think that's where it gets to. And, you know, for every single time, you know, Jerry Kuzman hit 2 home runs, right. Doc Gooden hit 7 in his career, Seaver hit 6.
Right.
For every one of those moments, and Doc was actually Doc was a 197 hitter. And for every decent event like that, mm-hmm. is it worth sacrificing? Nobody's looked at it this way. A homestand a season or a road trip.
Well, that was
pitchers.
That would be the 1998 Marlins.
Yeah, well, that's true. Who I always will remember on a Mets show, gave the Mets a heck of a time down the stretch. Actually got a couple of big wins against them. Very obnoxious. That was it's funny because we'll talk about history real quick. Jimmy Leland was the manager of that team year after they win, and he played every one of those games. I'll give him credit. His teams played to win, mm-hmm. and they were tough outs. I was at a couple of those Met Marlin games at Shea Stadium down the stretch. They won 2 out of 3 that weekend. But what I remember about that weekend in September, right before they collapsed, was that the Marlins were in pretty much every game. And they used to be just sweated out. You got to give them credit on that. So you're right. The 1998 Marlins. That's interesting you said that.
But I have some numbers on if you're interested. So
yep,
if we go back to say the early 1900s, 1900 to 1989, and these are not my numbers. This is from an excellent article from the Sabre. Let me put a plug in for Sabre for those people that are not mm-hmm. members, Society for American Baseball Research. We have a magazine that comes out quarterly. Maybe it's only mm-hmm. twice a year now. And this is a magazine, an article written by a guy by the name of John Cronin, who talks about the designated hitter. This came out of the 2016 edition of the magazine, but he talks about batting averages. And so from 1900, pitchers hit between 1900 and 1909, they were hitting .181. By the time the designated hitter rule got to the American League, pitchers were hitting .147.
Wow.
And the only time they ever had a decent batting averages was in the 1870s. And of course, I'm not that old and I don't remember the 1870s, but
neither do I.
Yeah, they hit
the jokes will be there. Neither do I.
Right.
So that's interesting you said that. That's really
so the variations between the hitting, when the designated hitter came in, the variation was 110 points difference between the average pitcher batting average and, of course, an average player batting average.
Absolutely. So loose shift, baseball and law. Seems like we're in agreement here. You know, you still have a lot of fans. And you talk about strategy. I think having the ability to make pitching changes a little more freely – to me, the strategy has always been, and this is my personal opinion, the chess match of the matchup. See, I'm always a little bit different. A hit and run, okay, great, all that. First to third, those things could still happen. But to me, it's always been, okay, I'm the manager now, seventh inning. Before you had 3-batter rule, lefty, righty. What would I do here? And it's also me working with the pitcher on his sequencing. Now, I'm doing a nuanced fan approach here, but I like to watch and go, okay, would I throw curveball? Would I throw slider? Maybe hit him on the inside corner. And then you get kind of excited when you're right because you're like, it's mental bubblegum, I would use the term. So to me, that's where my enjoyment is. Maybe I'm looking at it from that point of view. But as long as you have the pitcher and the batter and the matchups and things like that, I don't see where a designated hitter would take away from the enjoyment.
What I liked about the designated hitter was in the World Series. And so I really thought that the designated hitter was always to the advantage of the National League team because at least their pitchers got to hit.
Sure.
And so, you know, maybe through the first six innings, their pitchers were hitting, where in the American League, when they're coming up those first six innings, the last time they held a bat was maybe, you know, maybe batting practice the week before the World Series, just so they remember how to hold a baseball bat. So I always thought that was a big advantage to the National League, being able to have the pitcher bat in their home ballpark.
Now, while I have you on, the Hall of Fame vote came out. Nobody was elected. This is one of the fun times of the year. It's one of the more frustrating. It's one of the more outlandish. I mean, how people – for a game that everybody says is dying, the anger and the discourse this morning on Twitter, which I know is a very small percentage of the population, but I'm sure talk radio and, you know, whatever virtual Zoom meetings people were having, it were baseball fans, it came up. And what's interesting is, and I had Kevin Kernan of Ball 9, formerly the New York Post, on Sunday, and he basically said, you know, at some point, maybe it's time for him to kind of throw these steroids guys to the committee and have the Hall of Fame figure it out. And then I see Schilling and Schilling's request. And to me, the debate on Schilling and where it's being lost is whether he is a Hall of Famer as a player. He's not a shoo-in. So all the politics and the nonsense, and I get that. I know why he's getting heat because of that. But to me, I don't know if that exactly why he didn't get voted in. Maybe. I think there's a component, but I think that there's a true debate on that. What I get concerned about is now I see writers when Schilling made his request for the BBWAA to take me out. And, you know, you're getting to the point where there's a real, at least from a fan perspective, where maybe like the other leagues, the committee, you know, take a committee of different errors and turn it into that, because I think the confidence in the process is down because everybody's now. And I had a friend of mine who said on Facebook today, the writers have turned it into about them, putting videos out and things like that. And that's not good because it should be about the players and promoting the game. As a Sabre member, I think this is really an interesting topic. What is your thoughts on that? Because there's a lot to unpack there.
Well, you know, it's kind of gone back and forth. So I don't know if you read Craig Calcaterra at all.
Yes.
He has the morning. I'll give him a plug because I don't get
morning,
it free.
Coffee, morning coffee. Yeah.
Cup of coffee. And it's like my first read in the morning between 6:30 and 10 to 7 whenever he has it out before I go to court. And sure. His position is, you know, look, it's a museum. It's there because it brings in business to Cooperstown. But you got these baseball writers saying who should be in a Hall of Fame or not. And who says that they're the, and I don't want to use all his words because I may not be quoting them right, but what gives them the right to say this is the Hall of Fame per se? And we can debate about, like Art Shamsky has been really plugging hard for Gil Hodges the last couple of years. And he put out a tweet this morning talking about how all these people that had finished below Gil in voting somehow wound up in the Hall of Fame, and Gil is not yet in the Hall of Fame, and Mrs. Hodges is still alive, and they really were pushing to, hey, can we get him in the Hall of Fame while she's still alive, living in the same house on Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn.
Amazing. Isn't it amazing?
Amazing.
Still living in this
really
Bedford
is.
Avenue in Brooklyn. Still yeah. Amazing still, how that works.
It is. And so the Baseball Hall of Fame, we get into these arguments because if you say character counts, then you get the argument that Ty Cobb shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. Okay, that's usually the first name that comes up. Well, you know, Ty Cobb shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. And then believe it or not, there's Pud Galvin was the first pitcher to – he was Cy Young before Cy Young pitched. Pud Galvin was the first pitcher to win 300 games in the major leagues. In 1889 – again, I wasn't there for it, but I've studied this. In 1889, he admitted to using – performance-enhancing drugs. He used something called monkey testosterone.
Right.
I tweeted about that this morning because my comment was he's still the only person in the Hall of Fame who has admitted to using PEDs. And he got elected into the Hall of Fame. It took him until 1965 before he was brought into the Hall of Fame. So there is precedent that somebody who admittedly used a substance, and he was embraced by the media. The media thought that was really cool. I can't remember.
Gaylord Perry was kind of a bigger than life. Joe Negro with the sandpaper.
Yeah.
We've gotten a little, what bothers me about morals is that yes, there is right and wrong. We know there's some obvious right and wrong, but we could really go nuance with this, Lou, and start to say, well, this guy's bad because he ticked this person off. Or, you know, at one point, Dale Murphy, who's a great guy, I've had a chance to interview him, didn't want women in the locker room because religious beliefs, not agreeing with it, not defending it, but is that reason enough to say morally? Like, we're really getting into a really bit of a hornet's nest, and it bothers me because, and Bob Klapisch wrote a great article over at The Record where he said even the BBWAA has their issues where they make awards for certain writers, and Bill Conlon, who got an award, Philadelphia writer, has since been accused of misconduct. Now, the only reason he's not being charged is because, and I don't want to get into it on the show, it's a family show, but is because it's past the statute of limits. Mm-hmm. I don't think he should lose his award. We can't go back and erase history. There's a lot of bad history in baseball. But do you want to go back and erase it? You're a Sabre member. Do you want to erase and make the perfect? Do we want to erase the pre-integration? Do we want to erase the bad things? Because we learn from it. And it makes history and it makes us better, I think. That's always been my part.
We've taken Kennesaw Mountain Landis's name off the most valuable player trophy. Not we, but baseball.
Yes. Baseball. Right.
Because of the things that he didn't do as a commissioner, what he could have done as a commissioner. He was not proactive in integrating the game. You know, we talk about how he saved the integrity of the game, but he didn't go a step further to do what would have been right. And now we're really learning those stories even more and more on what was not done, what was kept hidden as opposed to what was done. So his name comes off the Most Valuable Player Award.
I've even gone to say I look at pre-integration numbers and I have to say they're not the best of the best. You have a but, and we don't know how good some of these stars were. Mm-hmm. And we're not allowed to play ball. But, I said the other day, if you go post-integration, Seaver, Maddox, Clemens, take the steroids out, might be the three best pitchers all time because Walter Johnson didn't play against African-Americans. I mean, think about that. Cy Young did not, the award. So it's very – you're starting to get into a very nuanced debate that's got a very slippery
slope. Bob Gibson, who had the lowest ERA in the history of the world. And then, your ERA was too low, so we're going to change the height of the mound.
We're going to change the mound.
Here's the question. Had it been a white pitcher that did that, would they have changed the height of the mound?
We don't know. And that's in the midst of the civil rights movement. You know, that's in the midst of all that. So there's so much you can go into, and I worry because – morals are moving the goalpost. I don't know who it was who said, O.J. Simpson is still in the Hall of Fame.
They didn't take him out.
Different sport, still in the Hall of Fame.
Well,
a jury
acquitted.
I mean, it's really tough. I don't think there's kids out there putting O.J. Simpson's Buffalo Bills poster on their wall. It'd be tough for me. But I think we're a very interesting society now where we're trying to correct everything and make it perfect. And the imperfection is what I think makes baseball, even though some of it's ugly, makes it fun.
No one's been taken out of the Hall of Fame. So there's never been a move to remove someone from the Hall of Fame. We've read, again, when you read stories, and then that's where you come into the thing about, well, if he did this and this one did this, then why shouldn't this one get in? My belief is, and I may be starting to be in the minority, but Pete Rose lied. Mm-hmm. We know he lied. I'm not taking away a single hit from Pete Rose, but he lied. And then he told the truth when it suited him best.
Sure.
The ball players were using performance-enhancing drugs as they were hitting home runs like no one's ever seen before. My son, who's now in his early 30s, said that when growing up, Mark McGwire was his favorite player. And he has said so many times, he goes, my whole childhood like is ruined because I was rooting for a cheater.
Right.
I think that, and not that ball players should be role models, because some of them will tell you, look, I'm not a role model. You know, I'm a ball player. I'm going to make mistakes and I'm going to go out there and do things. In the 1940s and 1950s, when the reporters traveled with the team on buses and trains, there was a lot of stuff that never got published. That sure, had sure. there been the internet then, and had there been, you know, everything else, that stuff would have been out there and would have been published right away. And we might have a different view of some of these ball players.
If Lou Schiff had a Hall of Fame vote, I'll put you on the spot. Who would your Hall of Fame vote? What would you have liked? Okay, better yet, let me back up. What would you have liked to have seen happen today? Who would you have liked to seen make it? Be honest, it could be nobody. No one's going to kill you here.
You know who I like on that list that only was in the 40s is Gary Sheffield.
Yeah, you know, very good hitter. Yeah, you and know, he's a steroid guy. He's a steroid.
I know, but I liked him. But you know, that's my bias because of '97.
Right. So that's interesting. You grow up a Mets fan. You go down to Miami and Florida, and now you're all Marlins. You don't have any connection to the Mets. You're kind of all Marlins, and well, you got more World Series doing that. Look, if you think about it, you had two
and
versus
two.
The one. You know, and that's
86-69 and 97 and 03. And I've said this before, and I mean this. If Eddie Cranepool and Art Shamsky and Cleon Jones and Tom Seaver and all those other guys were still playing for the Mets, I'd still be rooting for the Mets.
But, that's amazing.
Yeah, you know,
and
when I came down here in high school, and I followed them and I rooted for them, and then the Marlins came, and I love baseball, and you know, I live in Florida. My kids were born in Florida. You know, I got married in Florida. My whole family's down here. So I'm rooting for the local team right away. I mean, I cut the ties immediately. It's like the
you got to take it. Do you ever take your kids back to Brooklyn? I took my wife back to show her old Benson Arch at one point. She's like, you grew up. She goes, you grew up here. You grew up here. I go, yeah, yeah. I grew up
and my
here.
Kids were never to Brooklyn. My wife and I years ago, I took them by the house I really grew up on in North Belmore on Sycamore Lane, right across the street from Jerusalem Avenue Junior High School. Mm-hmm. Took them to see the house there. And then my wife grew up in a small town in New Jersey, Greenwood Lake, New Jersey. And so we did like a roots tour. We were out in the Poconos, and we said, well, this is where we grew up. We were visiting cousins on the island out in Plainview, and it's all right. This is where we grew up in Belmore. And they go, that's your house? Yeah. I thought it was the biggest house on the planet. They go,
I know.
So small. That's your whole house? You know, I was like, yeah, that was the whole house. So we didn't
complain. And you never would have thought. I mean, I tell people, and I hate to say, I mean, because I get critics on iTunes saying, you're too young to be an old fart and to act like you're, you know, but I didn't have cable TV till I was 16. My early baseball experiences were radio, early WFAN. And that's why I think I do this, because there's that intimacy of the audio and that connection. I'm not much of a video guy, but I'm audio. And I think that's because I grew up listening to the Mets on Bob Murphy and Gary Thorne and Bob Murphy and Gary Cohen. And at back then, you get half the games on free TV. And eventually, by the time I was 16, when they actually – it's funny for people to say they didn't want to. There was like legalities about cable. There was areas where they would not wire you. Nobody could understand that in a pandemic Zoom world. That there were people. If this happened in 1988, we were in a lot of trouble. Let me tell you, we're in a load of trouble. I didn't have cable till I was 16, and it was like a toy. I was like, oh my god, I could watch all the games, the Knicks, the Mets, ESPN. And it was like, you know, now you know people are cutting the cord. So you know, think about it.
And I'm a little bit older than you, so going to bed at night, man, taking the transistor radio, sneaking it under my pillow and listening to Bob Murphy, Lindsey Nelson, yep. Ralph Kiner. And then if they won, we'd have a happy recap.
And then the song and everything. The happy song. And then back in the 80s, they would have the song, and I can't remember, the one from Goodfellas, when everybody's getting whacked, they'll play that after a loss. So,
growing up, and I listened to that. And then I also – listened a little bit to the Yankees, and then you know you had that time there was Mel Allen and Red Barber, and I forget who took their places, but that was a Met fan, so that you know that's kind of what I listened to, and so you grew up listening to games on the radio and keeping score. All right,
that was a big thing, keeping score when you went to the ball game.
I have a scorebook here. last year for the holidays, my son bought me 2 scorebooks.
There you go.
Here, and I used them during the Marlins.
Backward K. There you go. That's a lost art form too. Keeping score, the backward K, something along those lines.
And another lost art of people going to a bowling alley, not knowing how to keep score or letting the computer keep score.
I let the computer keep score. Right. You know, I also say there's a couple of balls that might have been jacked that I used to juice up my score a little bit too. I used to call them the Colorado Rockies ball. That was the way we used. I go, let's use the Colorado ball and get things going on the whole thing. So Lou, before I let you go, Baseball and Law on Twitter. You have a book. Let the listeners know where they can find you, what you got coming up, everything they want to know about you, because you got some really good facts. Pretty much every day there's something coming out of your account.
And I appreciate it. So it's really a labor of love. The book, it was primarily starting to be used in law school. This is the book. I don't know.
Baseball and law.
It's on Amazon. At one point, it was the number one sports law book when it first came out, and I was honored when Sabre named it their baseball research book of the year for 2017. It was my co-author, Bob Jarvis, who's a law professor at Nova Southeastern University. It was the best term paper, 1,000-page term paper I ever wrote. And so what I do every day is I'll come up with some baseball law related thing. For example, what did I do today? I don't even remember what I did today.
Anymore. I think it was the Hall of Fame one today. I joked a little bit about
the Hall of Fame. So I did that. The other day was the anniversary of the Mets, Joan Payson family, selling it to the Doubleday family. And so I made reference to the day it was sold. And I'll use headlines. My research has newspaper headlines from that era, whatever that was. And then I made mention of Steve Cohen buying your club. And I, you know, the Marlins have a great ownership group, but Steve Cohen comes in there and it's like he grew up a Mets fan. He's basically the same age as I am.
Kind of the same area. Great Neck's not too much different than Belmore.
Wait a second. Great Neck and North Belmore price wise. Come on.
I was trying to, but you know, you had the same kind of environment. I know the money. Okay. The money part is
same little. Roots, different bank accounts.
Right.
But you know, you've got an owner who seems to be like, just willing to spend the money. I did you see the video when he introduced the 86 Buckner ball?
Yep.
Is that hysterical? Yeah. Hey, you want to see? He reaches down.
He reaches down. Oh, by the way, I bought this from Charlie Sheen.
By the way, I bought
whatever it is, $250,000. Yeah. Charlie Sheen had it at some point. So a world that only you and I could imagine living in. And what's good to see is that in a sport that needs energy, that there was a poll taken by The Athletic, and they were saying how Steve Cohen's desire to win, and hopefully it's not just that new toy desire that he keeps that for as long as he owns the team, or a version of that. It's never going to be, this is the honeymoon, let's remember. And this has actually been a shorter honeymoon. Like, things have happened over the last couple of weeks, but hopefully that's a good example for others to, hey, this is an entertainment business. I understand there's a tax write-off benefit. I understand it's a very expensive asset, but if we forget what this is about, then, you know, the sport will die. And I hate to sound like that, because I'm in till the day I die. You're in till the day you die, but there's a lot of people, and you may know them, your kids.
That's another
may not be in,
and that's a conversation for another day. The death of baseball, because look, I'm 65 years old. Baseball to me is still the most exciting game. I enjoy it, but take a kid that's 17 years old and a really good athlete. Do they want to play baseball? Do you want to play basketball? Do you want to play lacrosse? There's so many other things there that bring them away. And the length of the game has something to do with it. You know, the three pitcher, three batter rule. I'm not in love with that, but I understand why they put that in. They want to move the game along a little bit. But baseball needs overhaul. Baseball needs to bring young fans into the game, and otherwise, I don't know where it'll be. That's a conversation we can have another day.
Lou, we could go on for a while. Two Brooklyn guys. I'll still forget Belmore. And I'm from Long Island. I'm out in the Smithtown area now.
Uh-huh.
Forget Long Island. Brooklyn. That's where we come from. Be well. Thank you again, Baseball and Law on Twitter. And we'll do this again, my friend. It's long overdue. Be well. Thanks, my friend.
Take care. All right.
Take care. And that's Lou Schiff from baseball and law. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more right after this.
Yogi Berra is a Yankees icon. His tenure with the Mets wasn't quite as historic. John Pessa, author of the book Yogi Berra, A Life Behind the Mask, described Yogi's final act as Mets manager on the Talking Mets podcast.
You know, when he finally was fired, I think, which was a relief for him, he knew it was coming the next day. He goes back into the Mets locker room, something I've never seen in all the years. I've been doing this for 46 years, and I've never seen anything like this, where he just goes in and, happy and shaking everyone's hands, thanking him for taking them to the World Series, and everyone in the locker room watched when he went up to Seaver, because Seaver had been advocating for him to be fired. And he said, listen, Tom, thanks for getting us the World Series. I owe you a lot. Good luck in the future. And it was completely sincere. And he's walking out the locker room, and there's a scene where, there's Ed Kranepohl, 30 years old, but a 10-year veteran. And, he tells the writer, he goes, Yogi's a really great guy. The only thing is he's probably too nice to be a manager as he's walking out. And, that just pluses and minuses to that style.
Listen to this and more at www.talkingmetspodcast.com. All right, we're back. Final thoughts. Really up against it here. I owe so many people the mailbag, the shout-outs, the conversation. I promise, and I said this last time, so I'm kind of going back on my word, but we're going to have a show. I think we're going to have a show on Sunday. We're going to have a show on Sunday. I think it's going to be jam-packed. I have some ideas of a guest. I'm going to try to make it happen. And I think we're going to be talking more Trevor Bauer, and we may be talking Trevor Bauer as a Met. I have a feeling that things are really moving. Just the gut has nothing to do with anything that I know. And if not, there's still plenty to talk about, and I'm sure that the Mets will be moving somewhere in some kind of direction. We'll get to some of the beautiful comments that people have made, and there's been some critical comments, and there's one that I particularly want to parse through because it was very interesting. So stay tuned for that. I want to thank Lou Schiff, Baseball and Law, interesting guy. Love having these Sabre guys on. Maybe more old. I know I get criticized. Well, Mike, you're too young to be this old school. Well, believe me, I'm progressive when it comes to baseball, but I also think we need to honor the history and embrace the history. And I think sometimes, what's the old saying? You don't know it's the good old days till it's gone. Well, maybe that applies to some of baseball. So anyway, thanks, Lou Schiff, for joining me on the program. I enjoyed it. Hope you did too. That's really it. Of course, you can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another podcast on Sunday. Big things are coming, I feel. Till then, take care, everybody.
your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.